Oh, well. We'll wait till it gets here then, and in the meantime, we will... I'll talk loud. How's that? Okay, I am grateful that that you've stuck around. I guess you're really, you know, hard up for CE today, but anyway, I'm glad that you're here. Yeah, hang through to the bloody end. It was mentioned that I'm Brett Horton, and I do work with special needs families. Today we're going to talk about 10 basic financial steps that we need to take with these families. Let me tell you a little bit about myself. You can see up there that I officially now have more letters after my name than I do before my name. That last one you may not be familiar with, the CHSNC. That is one of the newest ones out of the American College. That is Chartered Special Needs Consultant. Now, there are, I think I'm aware of three, I know of three, there might be four or five here in the state. I can tell you that I was the first back in 2012 when I finished my Chartered Special Needs Consultant designation. I can tell you that I have a few passions in life, one of which is my dear wife. Then I will say our five children. Then I will say our two grandchildren. And those of you that don't have grandchildren yet, let me tell you, it is fabulous. Because they love you all the time. I have to tell you this thing that happened Tuesday night. Their mom and dad, the two grandchildren are from the same family. Their mom and dad have to go to Mutual on Tuesday night. They both have callings in the church to go to Mutual. And so Grandpa and Grandma drive from Sandy up to Bountiful so we can take care of the kids. I mean, it is just tough duty. Of course, you ring the doorbell and they know that you're there and they come running. Well, what they told us was that Ellie, she's the three-year-old, she decided that she wanted us there an hour early, so she made the doorbell ring, hoping that we'd just show up. When we got there, she said, it didn't work. So they get us when they get us. But they are definitely a passion of mine. And then I would say the next passion that I have is working with families with special needs. Because they have unique needs, and they are unique people. And it's very easy to appreciate what they do. I'm not sure that my mic is working. I mean, it's working, but it's not loud enough so anybody can hear. What do we need to do? Okay, is that picking up better? Yes. Okay, he'll get it taken care of. The challenge that most of our families have that have special needs children is they don't know the unique planning opportunities or challenges or issues that they face. They may have heard some of them. They get rumors from their neighbors or somebody, but they really don't have the guidance and the help that they need. And some of them just kind of muddle through. Because what we really deal with, okay, disclosures, I'm not giving legal or tax advice. They have to work with their advisors. Okay. But the real issue that these families face is, again, what's important to the caregiver. Most of our parents, and I would say all of our parents, realize that they know their children better than anybody else. And nobody can care for them as well as they can. The thing that scares them the most is what happens if something happens to me. Now, okay, we've got a number of ladies here. Okay, remember the time when you had an infant come home in your house. And when you woke up in the morning, what was the first thing you thought of in the morning? Okay, was the baby breathing? You didn't worry about your husband, did you? Okay. What was the last thing you thought of when you went to bed? That baby. What happens if that never changes? Now, okay, your kids are all grown now, right? Or they're older, they're supposedly somewhat self-sufficient. Do you worry about them like you did before? Okay, sometimes you do. But in a different way, don't you? Okay, what happens is, these families that have special needs children, they worry about whether their big baby is going to breathe in the morning. And that's the same thing, that's the last thing they think of at night. And that doesn't change. And you think, wow, how do they deal with that? That's what they deal with. Something's going on. So they know that they're the ones that know best what their children need. But what happens if they can't be around? So we're going to talk about 10 steps that these families need to take, and we need to help them take so that they can solve this issue. Okay, the first thing is they need to plan for the future. Now, there's a lot of things that they need to take into account. We have three of them listed here. You know, whether or not they're going to need medical treatments in the future, what their educational opportunities are going to be, and what about housing? Are they going to live at home forever? Are they going to be able to live by themselves? How's that going to come about? Now, I'm going to tell you there's no right or no wrong way. There's just their way. Because I've heard some parents say, my child will go to a group home over my dead body. I also then have... Okay. It's not on. So anyway, they say, over my dead body, will my child ever go to a group home? I then have clients who said, I can't wait till he can go to a group home. So which one's right and which one's wrong? Doesn't matter. They're both right. Because the parent knows best what the child needs. Okay. Talk about medical treatments. By the way, let me tell you a little bit about the thing that I overlooked. Why is special needs planning important to me, and why is it so important? I told you I had 5 children. 2 of those 5 were born with congenital heart defects. One of them has died. 23 years ago, we lost our son. So now we have 4 daughters. Of those 4, our youngest also still has medical issues. She was born with essentially half a heart. She functions with half a heart. She also had a surgical procedure, you know, what scoliosis is when your back goes like this. Well, she had an operation to fix that, and the doctor came out of the operating room and said she has no feeling or movement below her waist. You know, they took us over to that room that you'd never want to go to. There's always a room right by the waiting room. You never want to have to go to that room, because that's the room where they get bad news. If it's good news, they give it to everybody. There's no privacy if it's good news. If it's bad news, it's lots of privacy. Well, then what happened is she also then had a traumatic brain injury in a week when they were going to do a CAT scan, and they had to put some dye in her neck to see what was going on with the injury down here in her lower back. Well, a blood clot went to her brain. She was in a coma for a week. Actually, for 2 weeks. The first week we didn't see her eyes. The second week we didn't hear her voice. And when that happens to you, that's the longest 2 weeks of your life. Because you wonder who it is that you're going to take home with you. Well, 73 days after she went into the primary children's, we got to bring her home. What she had to be able to do is walk up the 16 steps from the car to her bedroom. And that was, I tell you, those last two were the toughest. Because we had to go home on a Sunday. We went on a field trip to home on Sunday. And if she could make up the steps, then they're going to let her leave the hospital on Wednesday. I was helping her up. I was supporting her one arm, and she's grabbing the arm rail of the stairway. And we went to there were 2 steps left. And she was ready to quit. And she was crying, and I felt like crying. Because we were so close. And it would have been easy for me to pick her up and move her. But no, that wasn't the rules. She had to do it. And so I had to help her, and we had to encourage her to get up those last two steps. Well, she finally did it, and we cheered because she got to come home. Well, she is doing very well. She's now 21. She is, she's probably out of school today. I don't know what her schedule was. I didn't catch it this morning. She's has two more semesters, and she will be an occupational therapist assistant. Her left leg doesn't quite work as good as her right leg does, but she wants to be an occupational therapy assistant because she wants to help people learn what she had to learn. And I asked her, I said, why do you want to be an occupational therapist and not a physical therapist? Because she had therapy from both. In fact, when she was at Primary Children's, every day she had 3 solid hours of therapy. Okay, there was 1 hour of physical therapy, 1 hour of occupational therapy, and 1 hour of speech therapy. And she had to have that every day or the insurance company would not pay. So she had to do it. And they schedule it. Half hour for each in the morning, half hour each in the afternoon. And I asked her, I said, so why do you want to be a occupational therapist instead of a speech therapist? She said, or instead of a physical therapist. She told me, she says, with physical therapy, they teach you what you have to do. She said, with occupational therapy, they help you learn what you want to do. And I thought, okay, that's good enough for me. So that's my background, and that's why I'm so passionate about working with special needs, because I realize that I am part of that. And I realize, I can remember when when I started learning about this, you know, I got all excited, went home, told my wife, you know, like all we all do, we tell our wife what we learned, and sometimes they, you know, they roll their eyes and think, yeah, okay, whatever. But what she told me, and I never forget it, she said, I wish there would have been somebody when we were going through that could help us the way you're trying to help others. And I thought, that's enough for me.
Yeah, that's going to work.
Oh, boy. They can hear me already.
Let's see. Stick it in my pocket. There we go. Okay. Step number two is we need to make sure we review beneficiaries. Now, what we have to make sure, in a minute we'll talk about why this is so critical, that they don't have any more assets worth any more than $2,000. Whether it be cash, art, jewelry, doesn't matter. Okay, the other thing that can cause troubles here is inheritances. You know, someone's going to put them in their will. Uh-oh, it's not a good thing. Okay, insurance benefits. You need to know who the beneficiaries are going to be. Now, that's something that I'm not sure we do really well in our industry, is we need to make sure on those policies been written long ago that we revisit the beneficiary designations, because you can change them till that person dies, and then it's too late. There's no changing after that. Okay, the third thing is to have a family meeting. Okay, why a family meeting? It's been said that it takes a village to raise a child. Well, it may not be the whole village, but you know that it takes your whole family. And every one of your family members are concerned. Let's assume that you have a child with a disability. Doesn't matter what the disability is. Okay, siblings are aware of what's going on. Uncles and aunts know what's going on, or they know that you have your hands full. Your parents know that you have your hands full, and if you have grandparents still around, they know you have your hands full. They don't know exactly what you deal with on a day-to-day basis, but they know that you have your hands full. And maybe one of them is thinking about, well, I ought to probably include Johnny in my will, because that family's going to need something that I can provide at my death. Okay, that is a time when you need to discuss all of these issues. You know, what the future care options are. Perhaps you have a discussion about, if something happens to me, who would be the appropriate one to help us take care of Johnny? And also, that's a time to review the beneficiary designation we talked about just a minute ago. Okay, step number four is to create a team. Need a team that can help them make some of those decisions that they need to make for their special needs child. You need to include a financial professional. Now, I would even qualify this. You need to have a financial professional included on the team that has experience working with special needs, because there are some unique aspects to that that many of us don't quite understand. Now, if you need me to be involved with one of your cases, give me a call. I'll help you. We'll figure out some way to be compensated, but it'll be your client, but I'll help you. I promise you. It's that important to me that I'll help you. You need to be involved. You need to have an attorney on the team. And again, that attorney needs to have some experience in working with special needs. Now, I know every estate planning attorney in town thinks they can write a special needs trust, because I've seen a lot of them. And I can tell you that most of them are not written correctly. Now, I am not an attorney, but I can tell you I've read enough, and I've consulted with my attorney colleague that I understand what they're saying and what they shouldn't say. And if I have any questions, I go to him, and he keeps telling me, yeah, you're right. Because one of the issues that we have with special needs, we'll talk about special needs trust in a minute. So we'll get to that. Okay, talks about a health professional. One of the things that many parents don't quite understand is, so what's the future for my child? And that's a time when you could have a health professional be involved. Now, if you're dealing with something like autism, it might be a psychologist that would be involved. It doesn't matter. Each situation is unique, and there's going to be an appropriate person to have on the team. And then it talks about a guidance counselor. One of the big issues is schooling. I don't know if you've... Let me ask this question. How many of you have an immediate family member with a disability? Okay. Let me ask this. How many of you have an extended family member with a disability? How many of us have clients that have children with disabilities? Okay, I can see why you're here. Okay, who can tell me what an IEP is? Please. So, what's that? Have you been involved with one of those?
I have.
Yay or nay? Good experience, bad experience?
Yes. Yeah, a lot of times parents are uninformed, so they don't really know the rights and what to ask for and what services.
It's not the simplest thing they ever do, is it? Probably one of the most critical things they ever do, but not something they, or do they look forward to? That's why a guidance counselor would be important to be involved with the team, because they can give you guidance concerning this program. See, what happens with schooling when you have a child with a disability is, and it's based on the IDEA, which is the Individual with Disabilities Education Act. Updated in 2002 is the latest revision. What it says is at age 3, your child has services provided by the school. That's when Head Start comes. So if you have a disability, they automatically qualify. From age 3 through age 22. Now, as long as they don't graduate with their peers at age 18, they can stay through age 22. You say, well, what do they do during that extra 4 years? They learn life skills, hopefully how to live by themselves, that type of thing. And what happens is, once a year, the parents go in and plan the educational program for that child for the next year. And it takes into account what their abilities are and what resources they need and where they can go, and they make goals. And then the school comes up with, well, we can do that or we can't do that. The problem is it's kind of a tug of war, because we can have all these grandiose plans, but if the school says we can't afford to do that, then you're kind of stuck. And so that's where the fight comes, because you have to nudge them over the edge so that they can provide those resources. Okay, that's why guidance counselor is involved. Okay, step number 5 is to get additional resources. There are resources from lots of different places, but one of these things, there are a number of nonprofit organizations around that are formed to serve the particular disability of the child. There's, for instance, there is a Utah Down Syndrome Foundation that we're involved with. In fact, we have a buddy walk tomorrow that we've got to go to Logan and to support. There's autism support groups. There's a number of, with different disabilities, different support groups, and they know of resources that are specific to that disability. So that's what this is there. There's also government agencies that can provide support. For instance, how many of us have heard of DSPD? I know, it's a four-letter word. It's kind of a four-letter word. Okay, DSPD is Division of Services with People with Disabilities. What that is that's a portion of the Utah Department of Health that provides these kind of services. Now, there's also this thing known as the waiting list. What happens with the waiting list is you sign up for services, and until there's resources available for you to get the services you need, you get to put on the waiting list. And some people are on the waiting list for 20 years. Some people not so long. It's not a matter of how long you've been on the list that's important to DSPD. It's how critical the need. So sometimes when the need gets more critical, it comes up. But you never get services without getting on the list. So that's another thing here for additional resources. Okay, let's talk about government benefits. How many of you went to the session yesterday over here about Medicare planning? Okay, now they mentioned something real quickly, didn't they, about Medicaid? Now, if you remember Medicaid, they were kind of... oftentimes, in our industry, we like to badmouth Medicaid, because if you're on Medicaid, it's because you're poor and you didn't do proper planning to take care of your own self with long-term care, so you're on Medicaid. In this context, Medicaid is a godsend to some of these families, because it takes care of medical needs for the child. It also takes care of other needs that are not covered by typical insurance. Then we also have what's known as SSI. SSI is Supplemental Security Income. Okay, that's also an additional resource paid by the Social Security system to people with disabilities. Now, one of the challenges that we have is understanding when Medicaid is available and when it's not. Okay, because it makes a difference how old the child is. If the child is under the age of 18, okay, let me back up. The first thing to understand about these resources is they are means tested. In other words, it has to do with income and assets before you qualify. That's why this $2,000 we talked about before, that's what you qualify for if you're under that level. If you're over that level, you don't. Same thing with income. So, when a child is under the age of 18 and they have a disability, then what happens is the parents' income and assets are used in the calculations. Now, if you have the income, the asset level is always 2,000. The income level varies based on how many people in the household, so it goes up a little bit. But it's always based on the parents' income and assets. It's called deeming it to the child. Okay. But what happens is at age 18, things are just magical. All of a sudden, your child is considered an adult. Now, there's all sorts of issues we'll talk about here in a minute about that. But one of the things is, when you talk about these benefits, Medicaid and SSI, then the earnings and assets qualification is based on their earning and assets, not the parents anymore. So you may hear of some people that have SSI and Medicaid when their child's prior to age 18, but it's because they're below the income level and the asset level. And there's many families that play that game because they don't want to make any more money so that they lose that benefit. Okay. But there's also people say, well, I don't qualify. Well, that's not a bad thing because you didn't qualify because you made too much money. You know, darn, you made too much money. But when they reach 18, then it changes and it so that they earn it themselves. Okay, step number 7. Sure. Yep. There. Okay.
Can't qualify for this stuff. Hasn't been able to most of his life.
Okay. Makes too much money then.
Yes. But still doesn't make much money.
Okay.
Is there any planning we can do that if he were to set some money aside, just savings for the family, so that if something did happen to him, you know, lose his job, you know, this is, let's say, we should also have, where if he also lost his job, he might be able to qualify for Medicare SSI. Savings in the bank itself, he wouldn't qualify. Are there any things we can do that could help?
Okay, when did he lose his arms and legs?
Formally.
There should be. We'll talk about it here in a minute. Right, but he's already has the benefit here. Problem is, you're not on the benefit. Okay, we'll talk about it here in a minute. Okay, good questions. We'll get there. All right, let's talk about last will and testament. I know. Well, I'll be honest. How many of us do not have a will? Okay, guess what? You do. You may not be the one you wrote, but you will. You do. The governor wrote it. It's called the intestacy laws. Okay, now, you say, so what? For most of us, that may not be a big issue, because what will happen if something happens to me and I don't have a will, and let's say something has my wife as well, then all of our assets going to be, the court's going to split it four ways, because we have four surviving children. Okay? Not a big deal. However, what happens if one of those children has a disability and they're on SSI Medicaid? They also got 1/4 of it. And I would hope that my estate was worth more than $8,000. So if I died without a will, guess what? They just lost their benefits. And they've got to spend down all of that before they get the benefits back. It's hard enough to get on the benefit to start with. Think of the emotional strain it would take to spend that down to get back on benefits. Okay. I honestly don't know, because I don't know. Typically, they have their own laws. There are certain things that are going to be uniform, but those type could be different.
Medicaid uniform?
Yes.
Yes. Something like that would be the case?
Yes, Medicaid's the same, because Medicaid is funded by the federal government, but it's administered by the state, but it's still a federal program. SSI is federal program. So the qualifications for those two benefits we talked about, they're going to be same from state to state. Yes.
So you mean the will is the parents, right?
Yes.
So the parents, if they don't
Yeah, they would die what they call intestate. So the intestacy laws would go into effect. And in the state of Utah, that means all the children share equally. Even if one of those children has a disability, it doesn't matter. They're going to get their portion of it. Okay, so what you should do in a will is make sure that doesn't happen. You make sure that the disabled child does not receive anything out of your will. You say, well, that doesn't sound good. Okay, you need to make sure the special needs attorney is aware of this and does this, because he'll know what to do. Of course, it has to be updated periodically, you know, all that kind of stuff. But you need to make sure that the child doesn't receive anything out of your will. Because the next thing we're going to do is he's going to draft a special needs trust. And that's where that child's benefit's going to go. Please.
So is that what you're saying? Because earlier you said, like, all the assets is under $2,000. So that means you can help a special child to receive benefit from the government? Because right now we don't want them to get any assets from the parents.
Right. But what you want is all those assets that you would want to go to that child, you want it to go in their special needs trust.
So they can have a separate trust with assets in it and still get the benefit.
Yes, exactly. Called a special needs trust. And there's an unlimited amount of money that can go into a special needs trust. And they could have an unlimited number of them. Now, let me talk about one thing that's not up here, but it's a good time to bring it up. Thing called an ABLE account. Anybody heard of the ABLE account? Okay. It stands for Achieving Better Life Experience. Okay. Back in the tail end of 2015, President Obama signed the law, or the bill into law, that created ABLE accounts. They're also known as 529A accounts. They work very similar to 529 accounts, but they're for special needs children that have to have a disability prior to age 22 to qualify. And what happens is anyone can put money into, they can open up an ABLE account. Well, let me tell you a bit about the history. So the first thing is President Obama had to sign the law, which he did. Then the states had to approve it on the state level, which the state of Utah, I think, was either the first or second state to do that. Then the IRS had to do their magic to figure out how they're going to deal with the taxation, which was they're not. But they had to put it in the code. And then the fourth thing is they had to administer it from the state. All three of those things happened, but the state of Utah's kind of bailed out on creating their own state account. What they've said, and if you go to the Department of Workforce Services website and look up ABLE account, it's going to say, we're not going to do one, so go to another state and you can use theirs. So that's kind of what they've done. And I think the reason they did that is the problem with an ABLE account is you have to figure out the eligibility, and then you have to figure out the funding. Well, the eligibility is appropriately handled by Department of Workforce Services because they're also the ones in the state of Utah that work on Medicaid eligibility. Okay, but they don't know any more about investing money than fly. So that should come under the UESP, the Utah Educational Savings Plan people, which it would work just like the 529 plan would, but the problem is there's the eligibility portion of it. Well, that's over here. So it's like we're dysfunctional here in the state of Utah. So what they've decided is go to another state. So I know that Nevada has one. I know Nebraska has one. Florida has one, but you can't use it because they won't let out of state.
Does
Tennessee have one? I don't believe Alaska does. Now, it could have changed since I looked at the chart. There's a number of them that do. And what you have to figure out is there are some expenses involved, and you have to look at which one's most appropriate and the best. And, you know, it's one of these flip a coin and figure it out. But an ABLE account. Now, an ABLE account would probably one that he could use. What happens with an ABLE account, you can put anybody can put up to, well, anybody together. The most that can go into an ABLE account in 1 year is $14,000. Now, when the gift tax exclusion or whatever it is goes up from there, then that number will go up, but it's that same number. Now, that doesn't matter if it comes from an uncle, an aunt, grandparents. The total amount can't exceed that $14,000 each year. Okay, so, and then when the account reaches $100,000, then it would shut off SSI because there's too much money in it. And until it comes below that, SSI would stop. Now, it's not you lose the benefit. It's just not paid to you. So that might be an option there.
Does it have to be in the trust?
No. No. With an ABLE account, it has to be owned by the beneficiary. In other words, the disabled person has to be the owner. Now, if sometimes someone else has to be the, if there's a guardian, the guardian has to handle it, but he could probably handle it himself. But someone else usually puts the money in there. But that might be an option for him. Because money that's in the ABLE account does not count against government benefits. That's the whole purpose. The other thing is, it's not tax deductible. Just like a 529 plan, it's not tax deductible. It does accrue tax deferred, and it ends up being tax free if it's used for appropriate disability expenses. And there's a list of things. And it's quite broad, but as long as they're used for those things, then you don't have to worry about taxes on these accounts. Okay, let's talk about the special needs trust. What it really does is it protects that eligibility. Now, what it can provide a lot of things. The one thing that it cannot do is pay for things that SSI is supposed to pay for, which is room and board, among other things. So that's why you make sure that SSI takes care of that part of it, but this supplements those things. It's really meant to be a supplement to the other government benefits. It can actually pay for vacations for the disabled person and one other person to go with them, you know, like an attendant. Yes?
So I've got a client that's got a severely disabled son.
Uh-huh.
24-hour care. He's at home.
Yep.
He's most of the time in the diaper, in front of the TV.
Okay.
Like that.
Uh-huh.
So you do an SUL or a last survivor policy.
Okay.
Right.
Right. Yes. That is the appropriate way to do it. Because, of course, the benefit's paid at the right time, but you don't want to go to him. The other thing is you don't want to do, some people will say, well, I'll give it to the older brother, right, and he'll take care of him. Okay, there's no moral obligation for them to do that, and no legal obligation either. So that's not the thing to do. Now, you may make the older brother the trustee of the trust, but the trustee is going to be bound by the trust to take care of the child. Because you say, are there restrictions? Yes, there are. It has to be used for the benefit of the disabled person, not for anybody else. Oh, yeah. Oh, sure. But see, you get away from that if you put the special needs trust in place. Okay, let's talk about guardianship. There are a number of things. Let's talk about guardianship in this manner. Now, I told you the magic about age 18, because SSI changes, the qualifications changes, and Medicaid eligibility changes. The other thing that happens at age 18 is the laws, in its infinite wisdom, assumes that every 18-year-old can make decisions for themselves. Now, I know, we laugh that most 18-year-olds can do that, right? The problem is, when your child turns 18, you can no longer make medical decisions on their behalf. Up to that point, you're the one that had to make them. All of a sudden, you cannot. So what happens? You're stuck in a rock and a hard spot. Let me tell you a story. Now, this is a true story. I'll leave names out because he doesn't live too far from here, that he told me a story about himself. This is an estate planning attorney that had a son that was disabled, and I don't remember what he said disability was. It may have been cerebral palsy, something. Anyway, he had to have some type of a pump to pump medicine down his spine. Don't ask me what it was because, you know, I don't know all those details. But every so often, he kind of had to get cleaned out. And in order to get cleaned out, they had to take him to the University of Utah, it's called UNI. What is it? The Utah Neurological Institute? Yeah. That's where he had to go, and that would take about a week, and they'd get him all cleaned out, and then they'd get him set up, and they'd send him home. Well, it was one of those days, okay? So he was just really out of control this one day, and so they decided, tomorrow we got to take him up there. So they took him up there. And they went in and said, okay, we need to commit him because we need him cleaned out and do what we do. And they looked at his paperwork, and they looked at them and said, you can't. What do you mean we can't? How old is he? Oh, he turned 18 last week, didn't he? Because he had to be committed. And to committed, so he had to stay there. And they said, you can't do it because you are no longer legally able to do that. So the dad said, I couldn't believe that it happened. He says, I do this work. And we knew his 18th birthday was coming up, but, you know, it came and went, and I never thought another thing about it. They've been waiting 18 years for this time, but all of a sudden it happened. He said, so what did you do? He said, well, fortunately this day he was quite a bit more sedate than he was the day before. So as he sat in his wheelchair, they asked him, so do you want to be put in here and stay for a week so you can get cleaned out? Dad said, I went. Later that day, he started guardianship proceedings. Because when they turn 18, you can no longer make those decisions. So, medical. The other thing is financial. Because an 18-year-old can sign contracts. They can borrow money. It's no longer yours to control. That's when student accounts where mom and dad are on the account gets changed to a big person's account. There are other things. We talked about health care, financial, where they want to live, whether they go to school or not. The 18-year-old gets to make their own decision. Whether they're disabled, whether they're capable of making those decisions or not, they have the legal right to make those decisions. Yes. 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 That's the problem. Exactly. That's the problem. So what you have to do is you have to go to court. You have to go to the Third District Court if you're here in this area. I'm not sure what Utah County is. That's probably the other district. I know in Salt Lake's Third District. Anyway, pardon?
Fourth District.
Okay. Anyway, you have to go to, it's essentially probate court. And you have to go there, and you have to prove to the judge that your child is not capable of making those decisions for themselves. And when you do that, then they appoint a guardian, and oftentimes it'll be the parent, so that the parent can still make all these decisions. Now, in some cases, not a full guardianship may not be appropriate. It may be that they can handle their own health care, and maybe they can handle where they live, those things, but maybe they can't do financial. So sometimes you'll get a partial guardianship, but oftentimes you'll get the full guardianship. But that's what this is all about. Now, it talks about here when you're under 18. Under 18, usually if you have a guardian, it's because of something happened to the parents. So someone's going to have the legal right to make the decisions that you as the parent did previously. But when they're over 18, again, in order to make those same decisions for your child, then you have to have guardianship so that you get the same rights that you had. The reason you have to go to court and you have to have doctor's forms and all these other things, because what you're really doing, you're taking away their rights of self-determination. We don't take that easily, no matter who it is, do we? You say, well, they can't make up their own. That's all right. You still can't take it away from them unless you can prove in a court of law that it's appropriate. That's what guardianship is about. Now, the state of Utah made it simpler so that if you wanted to, you could do it all yourself without involving an attorney. Oh, boy. I personally sure wouldn't do that. There is what they call pro se guardianship. That's where you do it by yourself. And the law changed so about a year ago so that the individual, they call it the ward, in other words, the child, doesn't need their own representation. There's some arguments in the legal community that may not be appropriate, but that's the law. I would suggest that you get an attorney involved there so that he can help you through that process. Yes? Right.
My situation was very, pretty straightforward. We paid $36, went to the judge, and got all the paperwork and everything. But they helped you through that. So, I mean, it was very easy once you had all the paperwork. So, I mean, there is a way to do that to save the $2,000 when it's a cut price situation.
Well, and again, you're probably a bit more astute than most of our families would be, too. Now, I know that you can get it for less than two, but...
Yeah, I know. You get about 600, but yeah.
Yes. Okay. All right. See, there are 10 steps. We're almost there. Okay. So let's assume that you've identified a care provider. Someone's going to take care of your child after you're gone. How do you assure that life's going to be like you want it to be? Now, this is a critical portion of this, because you need, take number 10, the letter of intent. Now, letter of intents, I know, are lots of different things. If you're in the investment community, it means something different. What a letter of intent, think of it as a letter of instruction. And it's not a legal document, but it's critically important to have. Okay, how many of us dads on the 24th of December have put a lot of toys together? Okay. How many of us are like me, where you get the parts out, you get the screwdriver out, and you put it together, and it doesn't all fit? And your wife's in the other room hollering at you, read the instructions first. So the next year comes around, you do it again. Read the instructions first. So finally you get this idea, oh, I better read the instructions. Think of the letter of intent as your handbook of instruction for your special needs child. Because tell me about your child. I assume they're 18. Tell me what her disability is. Okay, let's assume that I'm going to be a new caregiver. Something happens to you and your wife tonight. Okay. The question is, will it take me 18 years to figure out what it took you 18 years to figure out?
Probably.
Uh-oh. Somebody's got a problem. It's me, but even worse than that, it's your daughter. Because she may not be able to tell me what I need to know. And last time I checked, I didn't have a phone that was going to call you up in heaven. The only way... Well, that's where I'm calling, and maybe that's why I can't get a hold of him. I don't know. But the thing you have to understand is what a letter of intent does is it provides a document for your hopes and dreams and information about your child. It tells me the doctors they see and the doctors they don't see, the ones you never want them to see again, tells them tells me what medication she takes, tells me how to get her to take the medicine, if there's a special way that you play tricks on her to get her to take it. It tells me if she comes home and she says, Brett, I'm going to get married. And I say, wonder what Dad would want. Because I'm the guardian, I have to give permission. And I don't know. What if she comes home and she says, I'm going to join another church? Wonder what Dad would say. If it's down on a document, then I would know. That's what's so critical about a letter of intent. And I believe that every child with a disability needs one. Now, there are lots of them. Lots of different formats. Short ones, long ones, some written, some video. I have a template that will help you go through and answer some of those questions that will be critical to have in putting together a letter of intent. You just give me a call. Come in, I've got to come get my business card when we're done. Okay, now, how do you start the planning processes? There's two parts to this, and we've kind of talked about both of them. There's a legal process, and then there's the financial process. And most of the times, most of your legal estate planners will say, get the financial part done first, because then we know what there is to plan around. Okay, when people work with me, I work very closely with Cal Curtis, my special needs attorney. We do this together because, number one, I know that I'm going to get quality work that's going to work for my families. And number two, I know that we're not going to be loggerheads at what we ought to do. We're working together for the betterment of our families.
Do you work in another state? If my clients,
like,
they're not in the state?
Yes. We may have to engage an attorney elsewhere. But Cal has connections with other attorneys in other states, yes. I can tell you why I chose Cal Curtis. When I was doing this training, we went to Los Angeles to a meeting. And when we got through, he said, so what do we do next? He said, well, the first thing you need to do is you need to contact an attorney in your area that belongs to the Special Needs Alliance. And that's a group of attorneys that deal with special needs issues. Well, I looked on their website, and there was one. I called him up, Cal Curtis. And I've been working with him ever since. And that started back in 2006. And I can tell you that I've never had a problem. In fact, okay, you got to give me 2 minutes, and I'll wrap it up. The first time I did a special needs trust, I'll never forget it. We worked together, and we got it done. And then about a month later, I got a call from my client. And she said, I got a call from the state that says that special needs trust is not going to work. So what are we going to do? I said, I don't know. I'll call you back. So I thought, okay, what did I do? I put my reputation on this guy. What did I do? What did I do wrong? So I called him up and said, Cal, Lisa called and she had a problem. And I told him what the deal was. And he says, I'll take care of it. So he called me back 2 days later. He says, okay, we got it done. I said, what happened? He said, I called the person up the state. I squared him away, told him the way it was supposed to be, and they said, okay, fine. I thought if he's got speed dial to the state of the Board of Health, state of Utah Board of Health, who deals with this, he's on my team. And I've yet to be disappointed. Okay. How can we help? Okay, I am a special care planner. I'm also, the designation makes me a special needs consultant. I can introduce you to nonprofit partnerships. I can introduce you to special needs attorney. And there's a wide variety of special needs funding options, or the special needs trust funding options that we can talk about. Certain things are more appropriate than other things. I can tell you the most appropriate thing is life insurance. What we need to do is you need to help them find quality professionals that can help them. To remember that they are the experts, and we're going to help them, that we have to think about lifetime care and quality of life. Nothing is more important than that to them, nor should it be to us. Any questions before we leave today?